In my lab, what we do is we do a couple of things, and one of them is this Casper dark matter search that I'll talk about today. But the other half of the projects that we run are very much in the spirit of quantum science and kind of condensed matter physics, and this has to do with magnetic resonance imaging at the nanoscale using things like NV centers in diamond. So Mina has done a great job introducing kind of dark matter and the different candidates for dark matter. So I will just put up one very quick slide about that. There is really a wide variety of evidence that we have for the existence of dark matter that I'm summarizing up here. And all this adds up to a prediction for this kind of fairly large chunk of the energy budget of the universe that has to consist of something that we call dark matter. And so for an experimentalist, this is a very important number to remember, that the energy density of dark matter is roughly 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. So this is kind of on the order of a proton mass in every cubic centimeter around us. So here is dark matter. We don't really know what it is. We know it's out there. I will mention two candidates for dark matter. And on the left here, we have WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. And as Mina mentioned once again, you can think of these as essentially atoms or molecules or something like that, roughly that mass, 100 GeV, kind of flying around all around us. But interacting with us and the kind of the normal standard model world very weakly. And the second candidate, popular candidate for dark matter, is much, much lighter. This is an axion or a dark photon, and its mass is a micro electron volt, many, many orders of magnitude smaller than the 100 GeV here. And therefore, I don't draw this as a particle, I draw it as a wave. This is one of very few times that I think an experimentalist has maybe a flashier graphic than a theorist does. Mina had little squiggles here for the waves. I have a GIF. So I'm very proud of that. It's probably the only place in my talk which will look more impressive than Mina's. So these things are axions. Once again, what this is meant to convey to you is that axions, you shouldn't think of them as little billiard balls, particles running around, but more as a coherent wave or a field. Okay, but let me start by talking for a few minutes about WIMPs. So these things, these WIMPs have been a very popular candidate for a couple of reasons. One of them is the WIMP miracle. So the weak interaction cross-section, which is the type of interaction that these things have with the standard model particles, it actually gives the correct abundance for WIMPs to explain this 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter to explain the abundance of dark matter today. This is called the WIMP miracle. So in other words, if you run the evolution of the universe forwards, the right numbers, the right orders of magnitude pop out. And the other reason why WIMPs have been very popular is that WIMP has the right properties to be the lightest supersymmetric particle. So people who were excited about supersymmetry really, really like WIMPs. And I should say, of course, that supersymmetry has not been found at the LHC, and that's been kind of a large fraction of the reason why a lot of people, or some of us in this kind of, especially in this precision frontier community, really diversified our interest to other candidates beyond WIMPs. But here is searching for WIMPs. People have been searching for WIMPs for many decades, and there's a couple of main modalities that have been used to search for WIMPs. One is indirect detection, and the other is direct detection, and kind of more relevant, I guess, to compare with the experiment that I'll talk about today, is this direct detection strategy, which essentially entails having a large tank of some kind of liquid or gas or a solid with which a WIMP can interact, releasing energy in the form of that basically gets converted to photons or electrons or something like that, and it gets detected by a bunch of PM photomultiplier tubes that are positioned to kind of look for these events inside the tank. And so the latest experiment that's actually announced its results is a xenon 1-ton just a couple of weeks ago. And here are the kind of cross-section limits. Now, this is getting down below a zeptobarn, and one yoctobarn is over here. And I don't think there's a prefix that's below yocto. So maybe by the time they get down here, they'll give up. I don't know. But anyway, so the other kind of reasons more fundamental reasons for this sensitivity to kind of these experiments to plateau out is this purple area over here, which is the neutrino floor. Namely, this is a kind of a fundamental background. So on some level, you cannot distinguish a WIMP from a neutrino coming in to your experiment. And this is the event rate at which the neutrino events will have the same frequency as the WIMP dark matter events. And these neutrinos can come from the sun, or they can be atmospheric neutrinos or something like that. So basically, this represents a fundamental limit to the sensitivity of such direct searches. And we're very, very close to it. We're just an order of magnitude or so away. I think the next generation of the experiments will start to probe this parameter space right here. And to go beyond the neutrino floor, such a detector would have to have directional information. So for example, to distinguish between a WIMP event and a solar neutrino event, if the detector here on Earth can tell where this incoming particle came from, then one could reject all the particles, all the events that whose momentum came from the direction of the sun. And by that, using that, one could actually push below the neutrino floor. However, all of these detectors, all of these experiments, they do not collect. They inherently cannot tell which way this incoming particle came from. And so what I want to do is I want to show you one slide for an idea that we came up with a couple of years ago at a workshop that's very similar to this, actually, for how to use diamond and color centers in diamonds to actually construct a WIMP detector that can have directional information, that can extract the direction of the incoming WIMP momentum. So this is what that would look like. The detector volume is no longer a huge tank of an inert gas or an inert liquid or noble gas liquid or something like that. It is now a piece of diamond. And it doesn't have to be one single crystal chunk of diamond. It's actually sectioned. So it can either be kind of sections that look like this, or it can be small little crystals of diamond. And this is surrounded by PMTs and charge sensors and things like that. So WIMP comes in and scatters within this diamond. So there's a scattering event over here. And this is detected and localized with these PMTs and charge readout sensors. And it's localized, and now we can tell which one of the sections the event occurred. So this has to be roughly millimeter scale localization or so, which is at the level that's already been achieved in all the noble liquid detectors. So the recoil nucleus that is produced over here, so basically the WIMP goes and diamond is made of carbon, so it runs into a carbon nucleus and then so it kind of leaves the detector this way. And the recoil nucleus obtains some kinetic energy from this event. And now what that does is it continues traveling through the diamond crystal, and it produces a track of vacancies, basically lattice damage. So this nucleus keeps going and knocks into other nuclei and makes a bunch of vacancies. And this track is about 100 nanometers long, given roughly a 10 GeV WIMP mass over here. So then what we do is we pull out this detector section over here. Here is a damage track, this red little track over here. And then we examine this detector section over here under a microscope. One thing I did not mention is that this entire diamond detector is not just diamond, but there are color centers within this diamond that have been prepared within this diamond, such as a nitrogen vacancy center, And I won't get into the details of how these things work or the physics of the color centers, but basically it's been they've been studied very well over the last decade or two, and it's been shown that these color centers can actually reconstruct the local, the measurements on these color centers can be used to reconstruct the local crystal strain in the kind of the local nanometer scale vicinity of this color center. And so what we do is we basically, once again, this detector section is full of these NV centers, and we measure all of them under this microscope, and we reconstruct the shape, the distribution of vacancies within this track, and therefore the momentum direction of the incoming WIMP, which is correlated with the direction of this track. So this becomes a directional detector for WIMP dark matter. The details are in this paper over here. This is a collaboration with my colleagues at Harvard and Berkeley. So that's all I'll say about WIMPs and directional dark matter detection, unless there's a question.
Yeah, sorry, just a very basic question.
Yes.
So why is it important that it's diamond as opposed to, say, graphite or?
Good, excellent question. So the diamond and graphite, all of these solid materials are great because they have a large density of nuclei, right? So to have a reasonable frequency of events, you want a large number of nuclei, and solids are great for that. The reason why we chose diamond is because these color centers have been, they are present in diamond, and they've been very well studied in diamond. Having said that, there's nothing intrinsically magic about these color centers. These color centers exist in other materials, silicon carbide. I don't know about graphite because it's not really transparent, so you can't really look at it under a microscope. Diamond is a great material in terms of growing single crystals that have very well-controlled properties and stuff like that. The main reason we chose diamond is basically because we know how to work with it and how to do these measurements.
So there was some experiments claimed to have seen dark matter a couple of years ago, but those have faded away, or?
I'm not sure.
Dhamma or something,
right? Oh, right, yes, sorry. Yeah, Dhamma, the Dhamma controversy, excellent. So I should have known this would come up. Yes, so this can take up the entire rest of my talk, of course, but let me just summarize that basically, yes. Yeah, so the Dhamma, what they see is an annual modulation of the signal from their detector, and it's by now at some huge level of 9, 10 sigma or something like that. However, they don't really know, or at least the consensus in the field is that they don't really know, nobody really knows where that's coming from. And there's no good way to kind of control for systematics and things like that. And besides, a lot of their, so I should go back to this slide, their signal is somewhere kind of over here. That's been ruled out by a number of other experiments. So I would say, again, I'm not in this field. As an outsider, I should say that my understanding is that, yes, there's definitely a signal there, but the community, it's not clear to the community where that's coming from and if it's coming from dark matter. And probably the consensus is that it probably isn't, but nobody really knows. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Can you just clarify, so these damage tracks produce strain that then you pick up spectroscopically, they shift the line
correct.
Of the NV?
Correct. That's correct. Okay, so as I said, the title and the kind of majority of my talk will not be about WIMPs over here. It will be about axions, about lighter dark matter candidates. So I will proceed with that. Okay, so Mina already gave a fantastic introduction to axions, and I will not try to replicate it here. This is my summary slide. It's a very light particle with spin zero in a very wide range of possible masses. It was proposed to solve the strong CP problem of quantum chromodynamics that we kind of discussed just half an hour or so ago. They arise very naturally in string theories from symmetries that are broken at kind of high energy scales. So as an experimentalist, what I'm really interested in is how are these axions interacting with standard model particles? And there are three such possible interactions. So here is what Mina mentioned, this is the interaction with electromagnetism, coupling to photons, also known as a Primakov effect. And this is the interaction on which most searches for axions have been based so far. And of course, as Mina once again mentioned, ADMX, the axion dark matter experiment, is really kind of the leader in this field. So here's the latest publication from about a month or two ago, and they are now sensitive to axion dark matter that is in this kind of QCD axion parameter range. This is really the holy grail. This is the sensitivity target for all of us. Everybody who's looking for axion dark matter is really shooting for this yellow line over here, which is the QCD axion. This is the axion that solves the strong CP problem of QCD. Not to say that there cannot be interesting stuff here, but it's not quite as well motivated as this yellow line. And ADMX is now probing this line over here. So this plot here has not been updated by these experiments. But basically, these green lines over here are the sensitivity of the ADMX style sensitivities of these kind of cavity style experiments. There are two more couplings that I will focus on today because that's what these experiments that I'll talk about are sensitive to. There's a coupling to gluons over here. And this is actually the coupling that Mina talked about as well. This is the coupling that is this the subject of the strong CP problem of QCD. So F here is electromagnetic field, G is a gluon field. And you can think of it as basically a permanent electric dipole moment of a nucleon that arises from this coupling. And this is really why axions were invented. Now, I'm just an experimentalist, so I don't really understand what's going on here. I'm going to write all of my couplings as just a simple non-relativistic Hamiltonian. So instead of looking at this, I'm going to write this Hamiltonian over here, which is basically an interaction sigma dot E star. Sigma is a spin of the nucleon. And E star is some kind of an effective electric field that I'll talk about a little bit later. And A is the axion field amplitude. Yeah, Leo.
Yeah, sorry, I should have maybe asked this in the previous talk. I don't know much about axions, but is it a Klein-Gordon-like field?
Yeah, essentially.
Field? So there's,
yes.
Okay. And
just a scale, yeah, it's just a scalar field.
Magnetic potential, I guess. Okay, pseudo-scalar. Like
yeah.
But you're not going after your measurement is sensitive to this coupling
this coupling over here. So the field itself evolves under it's basically the mass is the only term that it kind of feels. It's mass, so it kind of oscillates at the frequency. I'll talk about this in a couple of slides. But then there's a very very weak coupling to the rest. Of the standard model.
Is this field condensed or is it a...
Good, yeah, so it's maybe next slide. Can we talk about it? Yeah, so it's a good question. But for now, let's just talk about the coupling. So this is the Hamiltonian that I'm going to, that the experiment is based on. And there's a third coupling over here, which is a coupling to fermions, psi over here. And this is called axion wind. So over here, the non-relativistic Hamiltonian looks like this. It's a sigma dot gradient of the axion field. So this is why it's called wind. You need some kind of a gradient of the field, and then basically the Hamiltonian, there'll be some kind of an energy shift of a spin that's proportional to the gradient of this field. So at least in our collaboration, we call this coupling here on the left Casper electric, and this coupling on the right Casper wind. In our experiments, are searching for these two couplings. And these are the Casper experiments. Okay, so here is our collaboration. This is a few institutions kind of across the world, West Coast, us at Boston, and then at Mainz. So this is kind of the people who do the talking. These are the people who do the work. We're collaborating with Dima Butker at Mainz. They're running the Casper wind search using hyperpolarized liquid xenon. We are using spins and solids to search for the Casper electric coupling. And this is what I'm going to focus on for the rest of my talk. Okay, now before I proceed, I want to spend one slide talking about magnetic resonance. because this is really a magnetic resonance experiment. So I want to bring everyone kind of on the same page as far as magnetic resonance, mostly because our experiment is basically just an NMR experiment. So let's forget about axions for a second. No more axions. Just talk about NMR. So in NMR, my interaction is a sigma dot B, a spin dot magnetic field, just a Zeeman interaction. So what I do is I have a constant bias magnetic field that's created by a superconducting magnet, for example, and then I have a radio frequency magnetic field B1. So here is a spin. Now I'm going to do a spin a half because that's kind of simple. So here is my B0. This bias magnetic field splits the spin states, spin up and spin down states, by basically this much. If I have a sample, a solid sample, as I usually do in NMR, of a bunch of these spins, then because this spin down state is lower in energy, my spins get polarized into this spin state preferentially at some finite temperature. They like to sit at this lower energy spin state more. So basically, I can get some thermal or maybe optical polarization in a cubic centimeter sample. I will denote this polarization by, so this will correspond to a magnetization of the sample. Basically, M, this vector M. That's a polarized spins. Now, I have a radio frequency magnetic field B1. If the frequency, omega naught, of this field B1 matches this spin level splitting, then I have a resonance. And now what this B1 can do is it can flip these spins from spin down to spin up if I'm on resonance. Otherwise, no. But if I'm on resonance, then yes. And what this corresponds to over here is basically the magnetization can tilt. And once it tilts, because I have a magnetic field B0, it precesses. And now I just place a magnetometer next to the sample, which can be just a Faraday coil or something more fancy. And this magnetometer detects this precessing magnetization. And that's the signal. So this is basically an NMR experiment. It's been, over the last decades, a very useful tool for non-invasive imaging and studying molecular structure. So here is a picture of an MRI scanner. This is a hospital scanner, about 3 Tesla or so. It costs a lot of money, uses liquid helium, and there's about 25,000 of these hospital scanners in kind of medical and research institutions around the world. So this is a very well-studied technology, magnetic resonance. All right, now let's go back to axions. So once again, I'm going to focus on this Hamiltonian over here, the sigma dot E star. So here is my Hamiltonian, and now I'm actually writing down the coupling constant GD, which gives me the strength of the coupling. A is the axion field, sigma is the spin, and E star is some kind of an effective electric field. So once again, Mina talked about this. The dark matter energy density, we know. It's 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. The axions are very, very light that we're looking for here, roughly micro electron volts. So one could ask, what is the occupation number? How many axions do I have to jam in a cubic centimeter to actually add up to 0.3 GeV? And the answer is a lot. I have to jam a lot of them in there. So what, and then maybe this answers your question, Leo, what I should now think about, again, is not axions as an individual particles, but as a classical, basically a classical field, because the occupation number is huge. So I should think of this axion field as just some kind of a constant whose magnitude is related to, to this dark matter energy density. And it's now oscillating at basically the Compton frequency of the axions, mc squared over h bar. Again, this is exactly what Mina talked about. So now, if I substitute this into here, I'll rewrite my Hamiltonian as sigma dot something that's oscillating. And now, what I can do is I can say, well, this is something that's oscillating. I'm going to say that this oscillating something it basically acts like a magnetic field, right? Because I have a sigma dot something. It's essentially, to a spin, this appears to be a magnetic field. It's not a real magnetic field because it's the axion field, but it's basically a spin acts just like these axions are basically producing a magnetic field that's applying a torque on the spin. Does that make sense?
You also have an overall field as well?
Yes, yes. So that's next slide. Yeah, but all I'm saying is that this interaction to a spin, sigma, feels just like an oscillating magnetic field that's oscillating at the frequency omega A, which is the Compton frequency of the axion, mc squared over h bar. And that, of course, is some constant, right? So axion has some mass, so that's some kind of a constant set by God or, you know, whoever.
What determines the rest? What is E star?
Aha, uh-huh, yes. So I will, yes, I will. That's also coming up. E star has so far been mysterious, but it's an effective electric field. Good. So now let's talk about the actual experiment. And once again, this will run along the same lines as our magnetic resonance slide a couple of minutes ago. So this is our effective interaction, sigma dot B1 star cosine omega t. So I still have a spin a half. And I place the spin a half in a constant background magnetic bias magnetic field B0. So now my spin states are split. I have my sample over here. The spin states are split, therefore the spins want to polarize. In other words, they like to live in this bottom energy spin state. Now, I have this interaction over here. You see, this is my my effective field that's created by axions. If the frequency of this omega A matches the splitting between these spin states, then I have a resonance. And now this interaction can flip the spins. It basically acts just like the radio frequency field in an NMR experiment. Except we're not applying it, it's the axion dark matter that's doing this. And what this looks like in my sample, just like for an NMR, is magnetization tilts and starts to precess. And now, just as before, I place a magnetometer right next to the sample that's supposed to create, to detect this precessing magnetization. So, all this is an NMR experiment where I did not bother to put in an RF coil to flip my spins. I'm now letting the axion dark matter do the job for me. Okay, so now let's talk about choosing this kind of magical sample over here that I haven't specified yet. We, in order to build a sensitive experiment, we need to choose experimental parameters. And we want to choose them carefully so that our experimental sensitivity is optimized. So there are three things we can do. We need to maximize the magnitude of this B1. We need to maximize the spin density so we have a large signal, and we'd love to optimize the spin coherence time so we can actually detect this precessing magnetization for as long as we possibly can. We can average for a long time. And this is where, kind of in the title of my talk, I said I'm going to talk about quantum science and condensed matter physics, and this is, in optimizing these parameters, this is where these things come in. The sample that we're starting to work, that we're working with right now, is a ferroelectric solid. So that's the sample over here. The reason for this is that in a ferroelectric solid, this E star over here, this effective electric field, is huge. It's 100 megavolts per centimeter. Much, much larger than any real electric field that one could apply in the lab. And the physics here is similar to that in a polar molecule. So some of you may know this thorium oxide EDM experiment, the ACME collaboration at Harvard and Yale. They're using thorium oxide diatomic molecules. And basically, what we're doing is something very similar, except we're doing this in a solid. So here is a cartoon picture of what happens in a ferroelectric solid. Here are the atoms. And there's one atom, this red one in the right at the kind of center of symmetry. This is the symmetric phase at high temperature. When one cools a ferroelectric down through the ferroelectric transition, now this red atom is off center. It acquires the crystal acquires a polarization, electric polarization. The symmetry is broken. So basically, one can imagine a ferroelectric solid as just like a kind of a collection of diatomic molecules, polar molecules, that are basically jammed together at a very, very high density. This is good for our purposes for now. So it's this breaking of symmetry which is responsible for this large effective electric field E star, kind of the 8 volts per centimeter. The other great thing about a solid is that we can have a lot of spins. We can have 10 to the 21, 3 times 10 to the 21 spins per cubic centimeter, which is fantastic because that means a large magnetization over here, which gives us a large signal. And finally, one does not usually associate the solid with a long spin coherence time, but we don't do too badly. About a millisecond or so is what we've measured for these solids. This is the coherence time of a nuclear spin inside the lattice. So a millisecond, this is limited by spin-dipolar interactions. In principle, we could probably do better than this, but this is what one gets without doing any work, about a millisecond. Specifically, we've been looking at lead-207 isotope, which has a nuclear spin 1/2. And here is a partial list of the materials that we've kind of looked at. And we're starting right now to work with this sample over here called PMNPT. This is what it looks like. And the main reason that we're doing this is because fairly large or macroscopic single crystals of this are commercially available. And the reason for that is these are basically piezoelectric transducers. And actually, so when my wife was pregnant, we went to the doctor and she had the ultrasound done. The material that they used in the ultrasound, in the machine to actually make this ultrasound is exactly PMNPT, just kind of a smaller, thinner membranes that we're working with. But basically, this is commercial technology. Easy to get, fairly pure. So that's why we're doing this, not necessarily because it's somehow optimal. So, so we got some of these crystals. And what we wanted to do is to verify that we can indeed kind of drive this transition between the symmetric and the asymmetric phase. And it turns out, yes, we can. Here is a ferroelectric hysteresis loop for our sample. So what we do is we start here with a depolarized sample. We apply an electric field. So we kind of go up, create a polarization, polarize the entire crystal. Then we can ramp the field back down and apply an inverse field. And reverse the ferroelectric polarization, we can go around this loop as much as we want, switching the polarization from positive to negative, or we can stop at a point here, kind of apply an electric field and then ramp it down to zero to actually go back to a, on average, depolarized state. In other words, so what this is meant to convince you of is that we actually have really good control over the amount of polarization of, within this crystal, which is directly proportional to this effective electric field that enters into our equation. So basically, this remnant polarization of about 40 microcoulombs per square centimeter is consistent with this effective electric field. So, okay, so that's the sample. Now what I want to talk about is the detection in the experiment, the detector. Yeah?
So omega A is like the mass of the axion?
Yes, MC squared over H bar. Yep. So now I want to talk about the detection part of the experiment. The goal here is, suppose we do have a signal, how do we detect it? So we need to talk about this magnetometer here. There are a couple of possible options. NMR experiments use just a normal Faraday coil. So basically wind a coil of wire around your sample, hook it up via some matching circuit to a low noise amplifier, and basically get the voltage out. And at high frequencies, this works really well. Basically because the signal is a Faraday detection, right? So you get d phi by dt. So the higher the frequency, the bigger the voltage. At low frequency, not so much. So below a megahertz or thereabouts, people tend to use superconducting quantum interference devices, SQUIDs. And what these are, once again, kind of we're borrowing this from quantum information science and from condensed matter physics. What these are is a loop, is a superconducting loop with two Josephson junctions interrupting it. And basically, the fantastic property of this device is that the voltage across this loop is actually depends on the magnetic flux, periodically depends on the magnetic flux that's threaded through the loop. This is a consequence of the Josephson effect. And so by biasing this device, we can actually measure magnetic fields really, really precisely. And these are now commercial sensors, although people built more sensitive ones in the labs too. And these are really a workhorse for precision magnetometry in a very wide range of frequencies, kind of starting from below a hertz and up to a few megahertz. This is what it looks like. So it's a fairly simple device to work with. Okay, so first, when we started building this experiment a couple of years ago, we said, let's build this and let's test our detection electronics. So here is a setup that we built. Just let's just use NMR of protons. This is something that's kind of very simple. If we had done this about 70 years ago, we would have got a Nobel Prize. We're a little bit late, but we thought, let's figure this out anyway. So we built the circuit and we ran the experiment, and indeed we detected proton NMR. So here is what you're looking at here is the signal inside this detector as the magnetization is processing around. So we've applied a pulse. This is not axions now. This is, we actually put in the RF coil. We applied the pulse that tilted the spins. Now they're processing around, and this is the signal as they're processing. And it's decaying because they're losing their coherence. And here's a Fourier transform. And what this has allowed us to do is to say, good, we can calibrate our electronics really well, and our noise, as we hoped for, is dominated by the input noise of the preamplifier. So this is, everything is good here. Yes?
The magnetization that you get by applying a field is consistent with the nuclear spins are all free and there's the number of them that you expect?
Yes, of course, yeah. So the kind of, they're magnetized by this bias magnetic field that we applied. And then, yes, all the numbers agree with this was why we did this, to make sure we know what we're doing, and we do. So this is this kind of Faraday detection scheme that we're going to use at high frequencies. At lower frequencies, we're going to use squids. And so we thought, well, we should actually calibrate these as well. And so what we did is we built a setup here. There are three squids inside here. And we kind of lower everything into a bath of liquid helium at 4 Kelvin, which you need to for the squids to work because they're a superconducting device. And we took some noise curves to and we calibrated these as well. And basically, so here is a squid. Here you can see the noise is below a microflux quantum per root hertz. And with a pickup coil, we see some vibration peaks at low frequencies below 100 hertz or so. But still, the noise performance of the squids is at the level of a microflux quantum per root hertz, which is exactly what was specified by the supplier. And that's what we kind of put into all of our sensitivity curves. So we were very happy with that. We see some vibrations, and we really tested the squid performance in conditions that are under which we're basically going to use these things. So we're happy with our detectors. Another way we're using condensed matter physics and in our experiment is actually to suppress external interference. So suppose we run our experiment and we see this magical axion. How are we going to know that this thing is indeed axion and not somebody walking with a cell phone outside the room, right? So we would love to screen out the external interference and this is at Boston University, so the T is running right outside with, you know, many hundreds of amps of current and so on. So we want to make sure we don't detect the T and we detect the dark matter. So for that, we basically enclose our experiment in a superconducting magnetic shield, which via Meissner effect basically screens external magnetic fields. And so the squid setup we use to calibrate the shielding factor, and that's better than about 10 to the 8. Yeah?
Just want to ask, so back to NMR, I mean, I know it's a very elementary question. But
yes.
So this frequency is the frequency that you're driving with. That's your RF.
Yes, absolutely. So for NMR, I'm glad you asked this. Maybe. So for NMR, the frequency you're driving is the same as the Lamour precession frequency, you would say.
Okay, but if you're a little bit off resonance, you're the signal you were showing on your,
yes,
that's the signal of the draw of the RF.
So this is pulsed NMR. So we drove with a pulse, then we switch everything off. So we tilted the spins. Now the drive is off and they're rotating. They're processing freely. This is free induction decay. I guess I should have mentioned this.
That's AC.
Right now we're not driving. So the drive was at zero. The drive ended at 0 microseconds. This is 25 microseconds after. Yeah, so this is pulsed NMR. Okay, so good. So Meissner effect basically will save us, or what we're hoping will save us from external interference. This is the X-ray of what the experiment looks like. So this is a cryostat that can house 80 liters of liquid helium. Here is a superconducting magnet over here, and the whole experiment fits within this magnet. This is a 9 Tesla magnet with 3-inch bore, and that's what we're starting with here. So this is what the experiment looked like just a couple of years ago. This is when I first moved to BU, and this was my lab. And this is what the experiment looked like a few months ago. So once again, I should point out the people who are actually doing the work. This is Sasha, Gramol, and Janusz, Denise, and Alexei. And the entire thing is sitting over here, which we're about to lower into the cryostat down there. So that gives you the idea of the scale of this experiment. It's really kind of a low energy type experiment, at least from a point of scale. All right, so now let me talk about let me spend a couple of slides on the sensitivity projections of the experiment. Basically, just to kind of give away the punchline, we're gonna start to actually put limits up here with this kind of Casper now, we call it, this current version of the experiment. So that will be in a matter of weeks. But I want to tell you how well we can do based on the parameters that we've measured from all our calibrations. So here's a plot. On the x-axis, I think Mina showed a couple of these as well. On the x-axis, we have the mass of the axion. Nobody knows where the axion is. It could be over here, could be over here. Who knows? But it can be anywhere over here. On the y-axis, we have the strength of the coupling. Stronger coupling up here, weaker coupling over here. This region over here is ruled out by astrophysical observations of the supernova 1987A. And this line corresponds to the QCD axion. So its coupling is related to its mass linearly. The ADMX is actually not probing this coupling, which is why I'm not putting an exclusion region over there. But their range of masses is roughly like this, basically because they're a cavity experiment. So the cavity size has to match the wavelength of the axion. And you can't really, and they want as big a cavity as possible, but you can't have a cavity that's bigger than this, right? Because, well, you could, I guess, but it gets very expensive very fast. So this is really they're limited in the range of frequencies that they can probe just by the size of their experiment. I should also point out there's a paper that came out a few months ago where the limits on the permanent electric dipole moment of the neutron from the ILL experiment were used to place some limits at very, very low frequency. Again, this is permanent EDM, so they're not sensitive intrinsically to these kind of high frequencies of hundreds and hertz and kilohertz and so on. But they managed to put some really good limits over here on the left. So the current version of the experiment is going to take this chunk of the parameter space over here. So this is where we're going to have our first limits. And this is just with a thermal spin polarization, a sample that's about 5 millimeters across, as I showed, our 9 Tesla magnet, and so on. If we, and I'll show a slide on this in a few minutes, if we manage to enhance the polarization of our spins using optical pumping and upgrade our sample size and so on, then we can drive our sensitivity down here. Like I said, this is really the holy grail of all of these experiments because now we are sensitive to the QCD axion line. So there's nothing stopping us from doing that except the technology of optical pumping of the spins in this material. And phase three is if everything works perfectly, we're really hyperpolarized, we have a 10 centimeter sample, a 14 Tesla magnet, and so on. So this is the phase three sensitivity of the Casper electric experiment. All of these are basically limited by the sensitivity of the detector. If somebody gives us a squid whose noise level is not a micro flux quantum per hertz, but 10 times better, all of these move down by a factor of 10. I'm sure you're wondering, what is the fundamental limit to the sensitivity of this experiment? I'm glad you asked. Here it is. It's the spin standard quantum limit. This is this red dashed line over here. And this is basically a square root of n noise, where n is the number of spins. So this is the fundamental limit to this sensitivity. Over here in phase three, we're limited by that in the lower frequency range. So in principle, we should be able to get down there. And in fact, I want to point out this paper from 1985, where they actually measured this spin standard. This is John Clark at Berkeley. They ran an NMR experiment where they did not polarize their spins. They were only sensitive to square root of n, this polarization due to the spin standard quantum limit. So this is measurable. In fact, people have done this decades ago. So the point of this is that it's feasible to get down here. And in fact, I sometimes like to advertise our Casper experiment as the most sensitive NMR experiment in history, with a huge asterisk over here, mostly because the NMR people will probably take an issue with that. For them, sensitivity means something very different. In NMR, you try to look at line shifts, which depends on chemical structure. They care about sensitivity, but they mostly care about frequency resolution, so they can resolve these lines. We don't care about that nearly as much. We really want to push down the sensitivity. So it's a slightly different kind of optimization procedure, but still, maybe once we get down here, we can call ourselves the most sensitive NMR experiment in history. So basically, these are using existing technology. Notice the range of masses to which we're sensitive to. This is 5-6 orders of magnitude over here. Much more than ADMX, because again, for ADMX, the cavity experiments, to scan the mass, they have to scan the size of their cavity. For us, to scan across the mass of the axion, all we have to do is change the magnetic field, the bias magnetic field B0, which is basically the current in the coil. So we have a knob. If we want to be sensitive to high mass axions, we just run a big current in the coil. If we want to be sensitive to small mass axions, we turn down the current in the coil. It's easier to scan for us, which is what gives us such a wide range of masses. And at least in principle, our sensitivity can reach down to the QCD axion. This is a great simulation. This is probably a futile exercise, but I thought I'd do it anyway. So if we're at phase two over here, and the axion is at 10 kilohertz somewhere over here, this is what an axion would look like in our experiment. This would be this line over here. Yeah?
Why doesn't the maximum frequency move to the right when you increase the strength of the magnet?
Well, the maximum frequency, so this cutoff over here is actually set by about 20 Tesla, which is really the maximum magnetic field you can achieve, at least with present technology. Maybe we can move this by a factor of 1.5 or 2 or something like that. So this frequency over here is basically the NMR frequency of about a few hundred megahertz corresponding to a 20 Tesla magnetic field. It's pretty hard to get beyond that.
How can you reach that, though? Because I thought you said your magnets were...
Our magnet is 9 Tesla at the moment. So we start over here. So maybe I didn't mention this. I'm glad you asked. A 9 Tesla starts us over here. We can, of course, turn it down. So we can cover anything down here. But with a 14 Tesla, we can get up to here. Is that what you're asking?
I thought you said that 20 Tesla was what you needed to get to that.
14, 20, you know, this is a logarithmic scale over here. So maybe this is 14, this is 20. I'm just saying 20 Tesla, as far as I know, is probably the biggest. I think 22 Tesla is the largest NMR magnet that's been built to date. 14 Tesla is just something we can kind of fit our experiment in. So, okay. Systematics are basically effects that will mimic the axion dark matter that we want to control and get rid of. One is electromagnetic interference from external sources. I already mentioned that. We're putting a magnetic shield, superconducting magnetic shield, around our experiment to get rid of that. Another one is vibrations. So someone jumps around, this will probably, this will cause some vibration in our experiment that will cause kind of a peak at some vibration frequency. So in order to reject these and other systematics, what we're gonna do is, instead of having one sample, we're gonna put in several samples in there. And these samples are gonna be, their ferroelectric polarizations are gonna be in different directions. So therefore, the signals picked up by each one of these detectors are gonna have a definite phase relationship with respect to each other if the signal is caused by axion dark matter. So for example, this guy and this guy will be exactly out of phase by 180 degrees because their E star, which is this arrow over here, are exactly opposite to each other. Whereas all the other stuff, the external interference, for example, will be in phase. It doesn't care about the ferroelectric polarization. So we basically, we will modulate the effect by using several different samples. And of course, the ultimate check, if we are sure, if we say, all right, we definitely see an axion at 10 kilohertz, it's very easy for somebody to go and build an experiment and actually check, oh, is there a signal there at 10 kilohertz? Because this should now be a fundamental constant of nature. This is the mass of the axion, mc squared over h bar. So this is not something that changes in time very much. So a detection should be easy to verify in independent experiments. Next generation, we are doing some optically assisted spin hyperpolarization, and we're doing that basically by shining light and optically exciting transient paramagnetic centers in this material. And so here is some EPR data showing that we can do that. We haven't yet achieved hyperpolarization, but we can definitely excite these, so we're working on this. This is for phase 2 and 3. So the current status is everything is in place at BU, and we are performing ongoing assembly and testing. Like I said, I think the first limits should come out in the next few weeks. So once again, here's a slide that kind of acknowledges all the people over here on the left that are doing the work. It's a collaboration between Dima Butker and Mainz, Derek Kimball, Sarjeet Rajendran, and Peter Graham out in the West Coast, and my group at Boston University. And I want to thank you very much for your attention.
Proposals that dark matter is actually a superfluid. Do you take those seriously?
Yes.
Is your machine sensitive to that?
So, in principle, yes. So, there's I kind of avoided that discussion a little bit by writing this down over here, but in principle, it's all consistent with superfluidity. So when I wrote down this equation over here, what I'm saying here is that this axion dark matter is a field, is a coherent field, right? You see, this is something that oscillates at some set frequency, which is just given by the mass of the axion, mc squared over h bar. Whether this is a superfluid or just basically kind of a non-interacting field, or what exactly it is, if it's really condensed or not, to first order, I cannot tell.
Are there other ways of testing the superfluid hypothesis?
So I think an obvious answer to your question, maybe a superficial one, is that once we see something, right, then we, of course, the next order of business will be, okay, let's say we saw an axion at 10 kilohertz. Then the next question will be, well, how does that frequency change as our solar system moves around the center of the galaxy, as the Earth rotates around its axis? What are the temporal properties, the coherence properties of this field? That would be great to study. I'd love to study that. Now, beyond that, I don't know.
If it was really a condensate, you would have a constant part, right? You would have the background sigma dot E that's frequency dependent, which I don't know if you can distinguish from.
Sigma dot E, we are certainly not sensitive to a frequency, to a DC sigma dot E. This is more a kind of a permanent electric dipole moment experiment. So like a permanent EDM of the neutron would be sensitive to that. I'm not sure I agree with you that just the condensate has a necessarily a constant part there, but we can discuss that.
I think this Compton frequency is like the chemical potential.
Exactly, yeah. So this is kind of, yeah, so I'm putting in the chemical potential here. This is where this oscillation comes from. Yes?
So what is in the actual kind of experimental procedure you want to use? Do you want to use some kind of lock-in or decoupling schemes?
Yes, absolutely. So the first thing we want to do is we want to just kind of run the simplest experiment we can think of, which is polarize the sample and maybe scan this. So apply a 9 Tesla field to acquire some polarization. And at that point, we are basically sitting there. So maybe we'll do a calibration, meaning we'll apply an RF field to make sure that we are indeed, that our sample didn't fall out of the experiment, right? So we want to do the NMR and make sure that we can see this kind of oscillating thing. If the answer is yes, then the sample is in, we're sensitive, everything is switched on, then we just sit there. And if we see, and we basically do the measurement and we do a Fourier transform on the signal, and if we see a peak, then that tells us that something is tilting the spins over here. And then we compare different samples, and if we want to probe axions at a different mass range, we just sweep this magnetic field down.
But that noise will do the same, right?
Of course. Well, yeah, so there'll be, of course, you're asking what will be the properties of the noise of this, and that's why we did, of this detector, right? And so that's why we did all the calibration experiments. And again, we're pretty happy that it's white, at least within some bandwidth. Yes?
What kind of field stability would you need for the static magnetic field?
What kind of what?
Field stability of the static magnetic field. How hard is this?
Good. So at least the field stability that we see so far is basically almost... So we run this magnet in a persistent mode, which means that it's basically beyond what we can measure. So we run today, we run tomorrow, we see exactly the same field within the NMR line width, at least. But having said that, again, at the stability, if this field drifts, that doesn't create a systematic. If this field B0 drifts, what would create a systematic is something that has to tilt the spins. So something at this frequency over here. And in fact, we're going to sweep B0 on purpose. So we're actually going to go step it down.
Okay, let's thank Alex again.